Sure.
Hi, this is Paul, and I have a special guest today with me, Dr. Gordon Menzies. He is a professor at school in Sydney, Australia, correct?
That's right, the University of Technology, Sydney.
University of Technology, Sydney. And we are going to be discussing your latest book, Western Fundamentalism.
Correct.
So let's, why don't we begin? Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, how you grew up, and then we'll eventually migrate to, you know, how this book came about.
All right. That's a fairly broad question, Paul. Thanks very much for having me. It's a great honor to be here. I grew up in lots of different places. My dad was a research doctor, and that took him around a bunch of different areas. Visited the North American continent for a little while in Canada. I believe that because he was an epidemiologist, that's someone who studies diseases, that he was actually looking at nuclear bomb shelters. So when there's a nuclear war, everyone's hiding in the shelters, lots of dead stuff on the surface, dead people, dead animals, and disease can get in. And so he was looking at all that. I went to university in a small town about halfway between Sydney and Brisbane called Armidale, did a degree in economics, and then joined the central bank. I really enjoyed my time there. It was a great place to work, but central banks tend to be concerned with day-to-day issues, and I had more of a philosophical, deeper kind of interest in some things, although I enjoyed the day-to-day stuff too. And so when the opportunity came, I was supported to do a master's degree at the Australian National University in Canberra. I did well enough there for them to support me for a scholarship to do a PhD at Oxford. So that was a great honour. And I worked with a guy there, well, I had two supervisors, but one of them was a Christian economist called Donald Hay, and his book on economics and Christianity was a very good book, and I really enjoyed reading it, so I was attracted to go and study there. And then I came back and joined academia, and my interest in the deeper issues, deeper side of things comes out in my lectures. I've won a number of teaching awards, and I guess in a way the book grew out of my teaching, but it also grew out of a strange experience I had at Oxford University, if you'd like me to talk about
that. Yeah, go ahead into that.
Yeah, so while I was in Oxford, I thought I would join the debating society. So that's a very famous debating group called the Oxford Union. And I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would, Paul, which is, you know, disappointing. I got there and I found myself getting a little bit, well, to be frank, bored. And what I found was that people would tend to very quickly get onto political pragmatics. Now, I shared with you earlier that one of the reasons I left central banking and wanted to become an academic was because, you know, the day-to-day running of things in politics is interesting, but there are other things to be interested in. And so I went and saw one of the leaders, and I explained what I observed, and straight away he said, yes. He said, everybody who comes here believes uncritically in three things: democracy, free market liberalism, that's a market-based economic system, and sexual freedom. And these things cannot be questioned. They're sort of celebrated and looked and regarded quite uncritically. And then everything else you debate is on top of that. Well, I thought the Union was a place where people could talk about anything. And so that's where I got the idea that that actually a lot of Western people believe things quite uncritically down at the deep level. And so I called that phenomenon, Western fundamentalism. So that's what inspired the book.
So I picked up your book. We chatted a little bit just to get the Zoom stuff straight yesterday. And so I picked up your book and I started reading it. And you know, that story is there. And I really liked how you told the story in the book. I think a lot of people have experiences of this when they, for example, my father was a minister in the Christian Reformed Church in Paterson, New Jersey, but he mostly ministered to African Americans who had migrated up into Paterson in the middle of the 20th century. And so that was my church life, and my school life was Christian Reformed churches had a big emphasis on Christian education for day schools. So I had my school days amongst a bunch of Dutch immigrant kids, or two, three generations in, and then my weekends with a lot of Black folks, and where I lived with a lot of Black folks. And then after college, I was a missionary in the Dominican Republic. And so part of being able to see some of these fundamentals has a lot to do with when you step out of them, you begin to have experiences in other places and times where you realize, oh, human beings have a lot of presuppositional beliefs that they sometimes, some people, particularly if they stay sort of in a monoculture, have a very difficult time in seeing them at all. And that then creates for, as you said, some things that aren't questioned. And I think it's very true that, you know, your experience in Oxford, that, well, here are these people, and, you know, none of them can doubt that. In fact, if you would begin to doubt it, you find that people begin to get very upset with you and angry with you. So I don't know if you tried any of that at the Oxford Union, and what happened with that?
Well, that's interesting you should say that. So there was one debate where you get randomly assigned to sides of debates. And so one debate that I had was fascinating, because almost everybody at the Oxford Union would be very much in favour of LGBT rights. And the debate was about gay adoptions. And so I found myself randomly assigned onto the side that was opposed to them. And one after another of our side kind of got up and did their thing. And one fellow got up and gave an enormously impressive speech, where he went through comparing heterosexual couples and gay couples. And he alleged there was all these instability in gay couples, and gave names and dates for the studies. And our side lost the debate. We kind of had to. That was a foregone conclusion. Afterwards, I said to him, "That was absolutely amazing. How did you know all those studies and remember the dates?" And he said, "Oh, I made it up." And so I realized at that point that the Oxford Union was not a great place necessarily to look for truth. And I didn't spend a lot of time engaging with people there. I went to some of the debates. I spoke in one of them, one of the main debates, and some of the minor debates. Yeah, I didn't actually, I didn't do what you said. I didn't get into many conversations, because I came to the conclusion that in some ways it was a great debating training ground. But yeah, I had the impression that sometimes people weren't that interested in the truth of things.
Now, did you, just one thing I wanted to drop in before I get to my next question. C.S. Lewis made an observation that when he read back over history, and of course he read a lot of history, he noted that you'd find these terribly fierce, combative situations. And of course in history, these things could be bloody, but he often found that the competing sides held so much in common that they didn't debate, that we now, separated from history, would greatly disagree with them on. And he just made this observation that I think speaks a lot to your book, in that so often we simply can't see ourselves. Our eyes point outwards, and we don't understand our presuppositions. So, so who titled this book? You or your publishers? Because it's
I did. It's always just been in my head to be called this. I think you're right about what you said. People often say that travel and reading are good ways to get outside of your own presuppositions, and I think that's true. Often the assumptions made in the contemporary environment that if you disagree, if you find yourself in a nasty disagreement with somebody, it's because of vested interests. So, you know, they're supporting the patriarchy or economic exploitation or something. You rarely accuse yourself of vested interests. It's always the other person. But the go-to framework is that when people have strong disagreements, it's because of their vested interests. But then if you read, if you travel, or sometimes in ordinary life, you find yourself in disagreements with people of goodwill who are arguing well. And I think that's the moment when you really ought to question whether what's going on is that you have different presuppositions. That it's not necessarily because people are supporting their position in whatever power game they're into. That can happen, of course, but it's not necessarily true. And so I think rather than look at the surface of arguments all the time, it's sometimes really good to look underneath them at presuppositions.
Have you gotten, I don't know, have you gotten much pushback? Because fundamentalist has really become a dirty word. That's an, if you call someone a fundamentalist, you are, in many contexts, you are essentially saying you have been, of course, as you mentioned before, that there are vested interests. C.S. Lewis, you know, had a little story. He talked, you know, his Bulverisms. He talked about that, oh, you only think this about marriage because you're a man, or you only think this about economics because you're wealthy, or the other way around. You only think this about economics because you're poor, or, you know, something like that. And I think you're right that so often it's presuppositions, but yet fundamentalists are often imagined to be, I don't think we pause often to think about what exactly the insult is behind calling someone a fundamentalist. It seems to be an insult of willful blindness that here's all of this evidence making our conclusions and the rightness of our positions self-evident, but you are somehow deluded or hoodwinked or willfully blind to this because of some religious conviction, perhaps, again, because of some vested interest or some emotional weakness. Where do you, I mean, to use this word in your title, obviously in a little bit of a provocative manner, what are your thoughts on the, how this word is going to play? Because you're clearly playing on it throughout the whole book.
Yeah, you've raised a good question about the definition of fundamentalist. So, originally, the term was used, as you'd be well aware, by a group of Christians in the early 20th century who wrote a set of pamphlets called The Fundamentals, A Testimony to the Truth. And that was basically saying that Christians ought to base their beliefs and lives on a set of core beliefs, which actually most Christians would hold to. So it began at that point with the idea of a foundation. You know, what foundations do you use? Interestingly enough, some of the causes that people we might call modern fundamentalists advocate would not have been supported by those people. So James Orr wrote a book on, one of the pamphlets on Genesis. And although contemporary fundamentalists are famous for their opposition to evolution, James Orr said that he thought that the language of the Bible in Genesis was neither, it was pre-scientific, it wasn't pro or anti-scientific. And so I think that if you go back to the original usage of the word, the fairest meaning of it is stating a set of, I guess, unprovable presuppositions and then building something on top of it. Now, at the time that that was said, that was thought to be ridiculous and anti-intellectual because people believed at that stage that there were self-evident truths, and then from that, everybody could build up, every sane, rational man, and it usually was a man, could build up a from that foundation, could build up a system which would be clearly the truth. Now, we don't believe that anymore. So in philosophy, there's been a real turn away from that position, which was called various things, but I'll call it modernism, which is this tremendous optimism about human knowledge and progress. And now we live in a so-called postmodern age, which has cut back some of the pretensions of modernism, I think, to a degree fairly. And so really we're all in the position of building our lives on presuppositions, which at some point we can't prove. That doesn't mean you can't have rational discussions about them, but it does mean that calling somebody a fundamentalist is a form of, I guess, anti-religious prejudice, in my view. It's saying that because you're religious, you have biases and you build your position on these biases. But we don't. We're rational people. We have start with self-evident truths, and everything we build can be proved by science and so on. And I just think that's a wrong way of looking at knowledge. And I think, and I'm not just saying that, that's the history of philosophy in the West in the 20th century. So I think it's a word that's now used as a mask for anti-religious prejudice. And there are already words for saying somebody is bigoted or anti-intellectual. It's those words, bigoted and anti-intellectual. Use them instead of fundamentalist. And I'll say one more thing. It's a very good example of the fallacy of the special problem, what I call the fallacy of the special problem, which is you find some problem in knowledge or in practice of somebody's worldview, and then you observe it in religious people, and you say, that's a problem of religious people. That proves religion is crazy. But you're choosing to pin it onto religious people when, in fact, it's a general problem. So this problem of not being able to prove everything we believe is a common problem that everybody faces. Atheists face it too. And so it's committing the fallacy of the special problem to pin it on religious people and use the term fundamentalist.
So where do you think these, we can go through them one by one, or if you have comments about all three of them in general, where do you think these fundamentalisms in our culture come from?
I think in many respects, they represent a yearning for freedom. So democracy is the three fundamental. So I talk about, in the book, I talk about fundamentalism in general. And then I say that everybody, no matter what their worldview is, builds their lives on certain unprovable things. And then I say as a subgroup of that, that people in the West have a very high and uncritical regard for democracy, free market liberalism, and sexual freedom. I think they represent in many ways a yearning for freedom. So democracy wants to be free from dictators and the abuse of power. Economic freedom is about being able to do what people perceive to be advantageous trades amongst themselves without the interference of government and so on. And sexual freedom, I would say, is actually transferring the metaphor of economic freedom onto relationships. I know that's a controversial view, but that's how I see it. So I think they're all attempting to sort of get at freedom, but they differ in an interesting way, which is I think that economic freedom and sexual freedom draws a lot of its inspiration from a strand of philosophy which says that if you're powerful, beautiful, strong, you kind of have this aesthetic right to marginalize everybody else. Whereas democracy, at least at voting time, maybe not at other times, really proclaims the equality of all people. And so they're quite different actually in these ways, I think.
That's interesting. Well, let's now when you say, you know, a yearning for freedom, you're, I think, implying freedom from, in this case, obviously, and that will, that tension between freedom from and freedom to, when you get into all three of them, will obviously be, you know, will come into, will get engaged, because, you know, markets are not only, you know, I think when I think about these three and how they've developed, a lot of it seems tied to sort of, you know, what Charles Taylor calls the subtraction story, which is a dominant thing in the West, which would say, well, in the bad old days when the Roman Catholic Church had hegemonic power over Europe, and well, that was never their hegemony was never quite, you know, they were, if you actually read the history, the popes and the kings were often sort of wrestling for power, and let's say civil authorities be, you know, be free to grant bishoprics and, you know, post people in ecclesiastical office and so on and so forth. But the low resolution subtraction story basically says, well, in the past, everything was locked down by the Roman Catholic Church. And if you differed from them, you know, you would get burned at the stake. And whereas, you know, people were burned at the stake, and the Roman Catholic Church did have tremendous power, but usually it was sort of a collusion between the church and the civil authorities, because the kings also had power. And so obviously the story of the Protestant Reformation, where Luther's prince basically, you know, kidnaps Luther and locks him in a castle and says, I don't really know if I want you to burn my professor. And then, of course, you know, war will break out, and you have the Peace of Augsburg that essentially gives to the state, you know, the power of religion beneath it. Now the state can choose, well, are we going to be Lutheran or are we going to be Roman Catholic? You know, and on and on. But yet the subtraction story still lingers, that religion is the cause of all of this tyranny. And so if we can get rid of religion and let people in a very libertarian way do what they want to do, well, then we'll arrive at, well, in some ways, the words of the American Declaration of Independence, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then we say, maybe look at, well, the place that started this at first was the United States, and kind of a forefront in religious liberty and all of this. And look how well that turned out. So, of course, these three things are, you know, it's self-evident, says, of course, John Locke and Thomas Jefferson. So, and you're saying, well, so these things we sort of grow up assuming, and off we go.
Yeah, and I think that, that's what you say is very true. And I think, of course, religious wars and religious violence are a terrible thing. They're not necessarily, there's a danger of committing the fallacy of the special problem again. And if you look at the first chapter in my book, I actually assembled the top 10 violent episodes in history, and counted by the number of people who are killed in them. And you find that religion is not very highly represented there. And certainly as terrible and reprehensible as religious violence and murder is in today's world and was in the late 20th century, you'd never even find those incidents on the top 10 biggest killers in history. Now, I don't mean by that at all to trivialize events like September 11, because the violent death of anybody is an irreducible tragedy. But it is an example of the fallacy of the special problem to somehow pin violence and wars onto religion, especially. That I think is a mistake. Of course, it's true for particular incidents, but with, you know, for example, communism, an ideology which is avowedly atheist, with all the deaths that communism has under its belt, it seems rather odd to say that deaths, violent deaths, are especially the product of religion. And so, as you say, the narrative of liberation from religion leading to some kind of paradise without violent deaths just seems misguided to me. I think that I mean, I'm a fan of freedom, and I'm actually a fan of democracy. But I think that it's a matter of being aware of what it's actually very good at and what it's not very good at. So what it's good at is stopping a small group of people oppressing a whole country against their will, and that is a really good thing. So it's a small oligarchy or something can't oppress a huge majority of people. That won't work in democracy. But it's naive to think that the majority is always right. And that's the premise of democracy, and it's a good system. And so we have to put up with the bad as well as the good, but you have to call the bad out for what it is. And so if you have a country like South Africa in 1948, constructed a racist state, or Germany in 1932, giving a lot of political power to the Nazis through a democratic process, or ancient Greece, some of their ideas about how adolescents should be treated sexually, and that was a democracy as well. If the majority is wrong about something, democracy actually helps the majority wrongness become law and work in society. So I think it's just a matter of realizing what it's good for and what it's not good for. It won't necessarily stop mass delusions becoming policy and being lived out.
So let's get into these three. You know, part of the bargain of democracy is either we say that there is wisdom in the mob, or we say that perhaps in a more skeptical view, well, if we can't know the truth, at least the mob will, you know, make its own bed to lie in, and that will afford a degree of stability. And you know, because the West, you know, the West has had, you know, there's Churchill's famous quote, and I think other people have riffed on it as well, that it's maybe the worst form of government except all the other ones. In your book, so in looking at these fundamentals, why do you want to do this? Do you want to disavow people of these fundamentals? Do you want people to be more aware of them so that they can see their biases? I mean, I haven't read the book, so I don't know. So, I mean, kind of what's the thinking behind it for you? Why do you want people to see this about themselves if they can?
I think it's important to understand anything that you believe. And so understanding democracy well means that you'll know what its strengths and weaknesses are. And that's always a good thing. You use something better if you understand its strengths. I think it also helps in conversation with others not to be quite as sure as yourself or arrogant. I think if you're aware of the strengths and weaknesses of what you think, then it gives a bit of humility. And humility is something that is in short supply in contemporary discussion. So I think that's a good, speaking as an economist, I think that's a good reason for reflecting on these things. What you said about democracy, I'll just pick up something there. There's a famous theorem called Condorcet's jury theorem, which says that groups make better decisions than individuals. And this is the way the story goes. If you select one person in the population, and they have a really good, and the probability of anybody you select in the population having a really good idea or a really good policy is 70%. Then if you just select one woman or man and make them king or dictator, then there's a 70% chance that the good thing will happen. But if you select groups of three, So you select this group of three, then another, or you just randomly select a group of three. They vote on it, and majority voting wins. So two out of three or three out of three will win. Then the chance that the good thing will happen goes up to 80%. And so the conclusion is that democracy taps into the wisdom of the crowds. Groups make better decisions than individuals. But of course, the math works exactly the same for delusions and lies. So if there's a 70% chance that you pick one person and they'll reintroduce foot binding for girls, that horrible Chinese practice that crippled lots of teenage girls and young girls, there's a 70% chance that one person will introduce that. If you select groups of three and they vote on majority voting wins, that goes up to 80%. So all majority does, all democracy does, is it taps into the so-called wisdom of the crowds. And if the crowds are deluded about something, well, then it'll just make it easier to introduce foot binding.
Yeah. So again, now we talked a little bit. Democracy is a very interesting thing. So I, as a pastor, one of the interesting things about democracy is, let's say, for certain kinds of American Christians that have in some ways strongly associated American democracy with their particular brand of Christianity, I'm always a little bit amazed to watch many of them so blithely assert that, well, the Bible is clearly pro-democracy, when actually the Bible seems often, at least on the surface, its language is a whole lot about monarchy. You have the kingdom of God, you have the kingdom of Israel. I mean, just historically, the Bible's, the Bible's fairly blind to democracy. It doesn't just appear in its pages too often.
How I'd put that as a Christian is that Christians have recognized the legitimacy of all sorts of forms of government. And then I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel that Paul's description of the ruling authorities having the responsibility to do justice and to, in his words, bear the sword to make sure that justice happens, that's applied to something that's perhaps not a dictatorship. It's somewhere between a dictatorship and a monarchy in the ancient world, the Roman emperor. So I think that the scriptures recognize that any form of government has certain God-given responsibilities as the ruling authorities. So in that sense, all the systems are recognized, but that doesn't mean that certain systems are better at fulfilling God's purpose for them than other systems. And I do tend to think that the Republican model of democracy, not Republican in the political sense, but going back to Aristotle, I do think that separation of powers and making a set of laws which the king or the president or whoever can't tamper with does help promote justice. That's my view. But yeah, I agree with you that just because something isn't a democracy, it doesn't make it an illegitimate government. There might be such a thing as an illegitimate government. That's an interesting question. But I think because it's not a democracy, that doesn't make it an illegitimate government in the eyes of the scriptures.
Now moving on to the second one. The second one is we're few people. So when I watch Americans, let's say a generation or a couple generations younger than myself, who it seems, at least in our contemporary context, older people seem to have at hand an idea of, well, things are the way they are because we've tried a bunch of things and these things seem to be working, maybe not ideally, but sort of okay. Younger folks tend to have a question more of, well, can't we do things differently? I'm sure if we apply some fresh creative thinking, things will go better. And one of the hot spaces right now, at least on the American political scene, and the whole rest of the world gets to watch without voting on the American political scene, and even though some of what we decide, everyone else has to live with, is the seeming resurgence of interest in a more socialist idea, especially about economics. Income inequality is seen as a very negative thing. I regularly hear people, complain about capitalism. They seldom define it much further than that. Yet I also find people not so much turning down raises or failing to play the lottery or wishing they had less money. More often I hear them just wishing they were more in the club of people with more money. So, the question of, and even the definition of what a free market is not a very simple one, yet that's one of the fundamentals. So what do you think people are at heart assuming in terms of what is right or just or correct and towards what end with respect to this second category?
Yeah, well, you've not given me a shortage of things to talk about there, Paul. There's so many things, including American politics. I'm not going to comment on, actually. It's not my country, and I don't want to talk from outside. Of course, there's always different definitions, but I mean, I think for what it's worth, you could define capitalism as something like the means of production or the capital or things that's used to produce things, whether that's land or factories, whatever, that's largely in the hands of private individuals rather than the state owning. And that's probably not a bad definition of capitalism. Free market liberalism, that just means that the institution of the market, ideally with a large number of buyers and sellers, because things get problematic when there's small numbers of buyers and sellers, but the institution of the market is sort of center stage for, the way that the economy runs. I know those two things are not actually identical. It could be that you could have a society where the state owns the means of production, but markets are relatively unregulated. It often turns out that the two things go together, and that's the case in the Western world at the moment. I think what's being assumed, I think that the reason people like markets is because they do have a lot of very nice properties about dealing with shortages or gluts. So it's a very, on a kind of outcomes basis, getting good outcomes out of a system, it does have a lot to commend it. So if there's a shortage in something, the price will go up. That will tend to make consumers shy away from it, and it will tend to encourage producers to produce more of it. And of course, if there's a shortage, you do want people to want less and producers to produce more. So that's the idea of free market liberalism, that if you leave the prices in free market liberalism to move around, responding to shortages and gluts, then you can get a system that works pretty well at sorting these things out. So I think that's what's being assumed, and by and large, I agree with it. I think that where there's nothing moral at stake in the goods in question, like a book or a table or something like that, I think having an unregulated price is fine for dealing with shortages and gluts. Where it gets trickier is when you start to think of people. So when you work, your wage is a price. And then there's the question of whether you want that price to be completely deregulated, to fluctuate. And there I start to get concerned because obviously someone's wage will determine on their productivity, and none of us is in charge of our lives, and we might all find ourselves in a situation where we just can't be productive. And then you either have to let people perish on the vine or you have to do something about that. And there is always a very good case for intervening in the economic system at that point. But I think there's another thing that I pick up in my book about the free market liberalism system, which is it's this mindset of everything is a mutually advantageous trade. And again, I think that's fine for tables, but the question is it really so great for people and relationships? There's this cost-benefit mindset that whenever you walk into a situation, you have a kind of ruthless regard for your advantage, and if the costs of doing anything are greater than the benefits, you don't do it, and if the benefits are greater than the cost, where you have a fairly narrow view of what the benefits and costs are, well, that kind of market mindset is okay for tables, but it's not good for other things, I think.
So now, a little bit later, when we talked before, you mentioned Nietzsche and John Stuart Mill's in this, which, of course, Mill's would come up in a conversation like this, because in many ways, at least in the West, the assumptions were set fairly deeply in this period. Nietzsche, of course, markets, people get nervous about markets because markets respond to strength. For example, in the United States, the new corporations that are dominating one of the more explosive areas of our economic and social transformation, Amazon, Apple, Google, Facebook, you might throw a few others in there. These corporations are exerting tremendous power, and power not just with respect to, Apple is a hardware company that wants to get as many people using their phones or using their products, but Google and Facebook in particular are essentially, advertising corporations that have they have designs on us as, it feels in some way, cattle. and the information that I generate and the market, the ways that I engage in the market, they wish to form the very world in which I live so that I will now respond in predictable ways that will be advantageous to their marketeers. So, markets are wonderful things in terms of responding to context, but what happens when the context itself becomes a player in the market?
Yeah, that's a great comment, Paul. And one of the assumptions that's generally made by academic economists when they discuss things is they regard they call it preferences. It just means what people want. They regard people's preferences as a sort of fixed thing, and then we design the economic system to meet people's preferences. And that's a very, it's something that taps very nicely into the spirit of the age, because we all feel that, at least with a kind of secular mindset, we feel we can make whatever preferences we want in life, and we set them up, and then it's the market's job to sort of meet those preferences. So that's the way that analysis usually proceeds. But of course, the irony is that we just know that that's not true. We know that it's not true that what people's wishes and desires are unaffected by the economic system that they're in. Of course, some preferences and desires are not affected by that, but some are. So I always love to say to my economist friends that economists have this way of responding to people when they criticize economics as a discipline. They say, well, if this is true, you go and make some money out of it. And the implication is that, if something's true, you ought to be able to make money out of it. And if you can't, it's not true. But on this issue of changing preferences, if I say to somebody, well, look, it's obviously true that preferences are not fixed things. And if the response comes back, well, if you think that's right, go and make some money out of it. Look at advertising. It does make money out of it. There's a whole science devoted to changing people's preferences. So I think you're absolutely right and tapped into a very unrecognized, part of economics, which is that the economic system you're in does mold you and change you. And so you can have a self-fulfilling cycle where companies have some power, it's limited, but they have some power to turn you into the kind of people who want the certain kinds of things that they provide. There's another few issues with the companies that you mentioned, of course, which are well understood in mainstream economics. One is when you have a few buyers and sellers of things, things get complicated and the system doesn't work as well. So in the case of monopolies or very few sellers, it doesn't work so well. And the other problem is joint goods. So goods are not just parceled off as separate things. Whenever you respond to something and you buy something on the internet, you're producing another good, which is information about you as a consumer, and that can be unsold. And so that makes things more complicated and in some cases open to exploitation. Yeah. So well, some interesting issues.
Well, I think in modernism, and I think, you know, as you rightly stated, all three of these, well, we'll get into sex in a minute, but at least the first two are sort of come out of a world in which there are certain presuppositions, as we talked about. And in my videos, I talk often about a monarchical vision, and that monarchical vision asserts that we have the capacity to see things from no place, to see things objectively as they are. And what the world is basically is a world of things. And part of what we see when we look at corporations like Google or Facebook is that they're not trading in things. And we discover, you know, all of these conversations we're having about, we're assuming we can know the good. And we're assuming that we are somehow an unreconstructed chooser who are out there in the market making rational decisions for our own good and good ends. Obviously, these things start to break down when you get to things such as tobacco, cocaine, some of these types of things. That somehow here we are choosers who will choose the good. So right there's a rather non-Augustinian anthropology about ourselves as choosers, that we will choose the good for ourselves and not the ill, and that the world is somehow out there in front of us and we will make these rational choices. And if everyone is free to make these rational choices, then, you know, people will group up and cooperate in order to compete with each other, and compete in order to cooperate both ways, and it'll all work out great. And but then, of course, when you get to the third one of sexual freedom, suddenly the marketplace of sexuality isn't exactly the marketplace of cars or shovels or, you know, the widget, which is, you know, in many ways, the widget is imagined to be a thing, which the kind of thing it is imagined to be says everything about the modernistic perspective on the world. So
I never knew what a widget was. Can you tell me?
It isn't anything, but it can be anything, but not an idea.
Okay.
And not a person.
Yeah.
So a lot of the videos that I make, a lot of the conversations that I've been having get into these questions of agency and personhood and what that is. And now when we get to the question of sexual freedom, well, now we're really engaging in the economics of personal exchange. And, you know, you're right in that this is it, the presupposition behind all these threes is that democracy will yield good, as if we're really clear on exactly what good is, and that free market economics will yield material good, as if we're really clear on what good is, and exactly the same thing for sexuality.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So if you buy a car, You buy the car until it's of no further use to you, gets a bit expensive to maintain, then you get rid of it. If you start to treat people that way, then you really have made a transfer of a market mindset onto your dealings with others. And that's, I think, a great danger. I think if I can pick up a few things, because you mentioned a lot of stuff about markets there. So it's pretty well understood within economics, and I think within society, and well accepted, that certain market transactions cause knock-on effects, which are not reflected in the prices of the market transactions. So a classic one is, you know, when you buy petrol and use it, you are contributing to pollution. And that's not reflected in the price generally. So that's well understood. That has a technical name in economics. I don't want to bore you, but it's called an externality, but it's well understood. Something that's come up recently in some very interesting experiments is the effects of markets on the social situation. So we're not talking about people yet. We're just talking about how we perceive interactions between people. And this has come up quite recently, and it's something called motivation crowding out. And if I can just say a little bit about that, it's the idea that when a commercial mindset walks into a situation, or when a commercial mindset takes over a situation, it transforms it. So a very famous example was an experiment where there were a bunch of daycare centers in Israel where people were turning up late to pick up their kids. So they must have had an economist on staff. They said, let's put on a monetary fine for turning up late. And lo and behold, as you wouldn't expect, the late coming increased. Now, why could that be the case? Well, the answer that the authors gave was this: that prior to a financial fine being in place, turning up late was perceived as morally bad behavior. It was thought of in a moral frame. Once a price was involved, turning up late became like paying for babysitting. And so if you had a really high-flying job, your time was very valuable to you, why not turn up a couple of hours late and pay this relatively cheap babysitting? So the entry of an economic or a commercial mindset into a situation can transform it, can transform the way people think in a moral frame to a commercial frame. And we all know how commercial frame works. You've got your own objectives, you make them up, you don't have to justify them to anybody, and then you do ruthless cost-benefit analysis on every occasion to get what you want. And so that is also becoming better understood as a disadvantage of, or a danger of, the economic system. But I think the last one is what's called commodification by some feminists. And this is the idea that not just that there are knock-on effects whenever we buy and sell things, or sometimes when we buy and sell things, not just that a commercial mindset will change the way that people relate from a kind of social norms determining it to cost-benefit analysis, not only those things, but that the people themselves are shrunk and depersonalized. And feminists call this commodification. It's seeing people themselves as commodities. And I think that these are the three, I guess, dangers of the economic system. I've spoken in favor of it. I've said that it's very good at dealing with shortages and so on. But it has these disadvantages: knock-on effects, distorting social situations, and devaluing people. Well, I think that if it's a relatively simple matter, if you transfer this framework onto the sexual revolution, my strong conviction is that you start to see the same thing there. If you give people unlimited freedom to do whatever they want with their preferences that they choose freely, then what you can get is you can get knock-on effects, generally for children and people who are harmed by relationship breakdown. You can get the transforming of social situations into a kind of market mentality, and you can get depersonalization of the parties themselves. So one of the claims of my book is that although people think of the sexual revolution as a kind of triumph of the left, the liberation of women and so on, and I think there's some truth in that, I don't wish to be misunderstood, although it is motivated in many ways by that, the outcomes have been a transfer of a market mentality into contemporary sexual ethics, which actually makes it, if I can use a hackneyed phrase here, like neoliberalism, just wanting to use markets everywhere in society for adoptive babies. That's the phenomena of neoliberalism, and I think the sexual revolution shares a lot of neoliberalism's ethos.
That's really interesting. You know, again, it occurs to me that, so part of the package of modernity was democracy, free markets, but also part of the package of modernity was, in a sense, when the Roman Catholic Church was called to account for stake burning and the like, was the elevation of the person. That even the church does not have the authority to take the life of an individual. And that, of course, sort of gets instantiated by that reading of Romans 13, because in a very subtle way, the state has the power of the sword, at least in our modern democracies, the church does not. You know, if someone has been, you know, recalcitrant in their tithing or church attendance, I don't have a church dungeon underneath living stones to lock them up or, you know, to do things to them to get to correct their wayward souls. However, the state has.
I'm going to church now. I wasn't going to before. I was scared of the dungeon.
Oh, there's a story behind the living stones dungeon. Anyway, I won't get into that. And it seems that the...
I want the story behind the red crab behind you, but that's another question for another time.
You have to look at Jordan Peterson for that one.
Okay, right.
Lobsters.
The lobsters.
But it's interesting that the third of your fundamentals is, it seems to me, a far newer addition than the first two. It was in the counterculture, and you know, perhaps we can talk about technological disruptions here too, because you know, we might look at Google and Facebook as technological disruptions of the kinds of markets that we understood General Motors or General Electric in operating within.
Yeah.
And suddenly with Google and Facebook, technology has severely disrupted the kinds of things that we can attach dollars to. Not things so much, but information now is, information is power, which means information is money. And then in the sexual revolution, and the, you know, one of the things that Jordan Peterson was quite apt to bring up, we don't probably have a very clear idea of exactly what inexpensive, reliable birth control has done to the marketplace of sexuality. There was a video on YouTube done a number of years ago by, I think it was the Austin Institute. I don't know who those people were, but the video was very much about the economics of sexuality. And their argument was that with pornography, with cheap and effective birth control, with the uncoupling of the assumption of a lifelong enduring commitment to, you know, heterosexual congress, suddenly the price of sex got very cheap. And what's been really interesting to me since I've started doing Jordan Peterson meetups is talking to a generation beneath myself, in which what I hear from them is that 20% of the men are sleeping with 80% of the women, which would very much be an economic observation with respect to sexual behavior understood through a market lens, which I think goes to your point. But you know, I want to highlight the technological disruptions of contraception, pornography, the social disruptions of the decoupling of, you know, let's say the shotgun wedding, where the father walks in and says, well, now you've bought the cow, you're going to have to pay for the milk. So I don't know how that fits into your picture here in the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting issues, and a lot of work has been done on this. So the Nobel Prize winning economist Gary Becker did a great deal on how the economy affects people's attitudes to marriage and not so much sex. He doesn't talk to in great detail, but he does talk a lot about marriage and about the way that we view relationships. Well, there are so many things there to comment on that I don't know where to begin. Look, I would say that one of the things that I learned from reading Stephanie Kuhn's book that I refer to in my book is that the 1950s was a particular high point in the status of marriage in the world. And she, in her view, it's because coming out of years of decades of deprivation and a world war, people were very prepared to count their blessings rather than hope for a very idealized life. And so people were prepared to stay in marriages and try and make them work. And marriage was extremely popular in the 1950s as a social institution. And then that started to unravel for many of the reasons that you said after that. Look, as a Christian, because I think that humankind has fallen short or is sinful, I don't particularly like looking back to any kind of golden age of anything. And that would be the same in the 1950s, looking back at marriage. So for example, sadly, I think in that era, there were situations where persistent emotional, physical, and sexual cruelty were tolerated when they shouldn't have been. And I mean, both for Christians and for other people. But I do ask the question in the book whether we've gone too far away from that. And I suppose a metaphor that I could use is, let's think about driving for a second. When you drive, you could get stuck into a traffic jam, or you could have an accident. Now, most people don't plan to have an accident, even though it's possible. They do plan for traffic jams. If you leave your house at 8:30 in the morning and it's a big city, you know you're going to be stuck in traffic, so you allow a bit more time. You build it into your life. But you never leave the house, I don't think, thinking, oh, I might have an accident today, I'd better prepare for that. In other words, there's something that you know that's possible, but because it's so unlikely, you screen it off and you don't adjust your behavior. Well, relationship instability is now so common that I think that it's moved from the accident category to the traffic jam category. Just to say, I think that there have been other times when you could reasonably expect relationships to be stable enough to invest in them, to bring up children, to build careers where one person stays at home and one person works hard at their career. And you could kind of rely on the relationship continuing. And you knew in the back of your mind that that doesn't always work out. There are tragedies happen, divorces happen, and so on. But you could kind of base your behavior like that. You could treat it the same way that we treat car accidents. We don't plan for them. But now the relational environment is so unstable and it's harder to rely on the continuation of relationships, that actually people are starting to factor that into their thinking. So you have prenuptial agreements, you have all sorts of things that are starting to be fed into the relational world. And therefore the danger is that people will be less prepared to invest in relationships, and that will self-perpetuate itself and it will become even more unstable. So I don't advocate for a world where persistent emotional, physical or sexual cruelty is sort of swept under the carpet in the way that it used to be. But I do wonder whether we've gone too far the other way.
That's Well, I think it's very, very interesting. And it, and to me, it's sort of, because when we say, okay, the relationship environment has become so unstable, it's very, especially when we look at that from the, you know, one of the questions we started at, which is freedom from and freedom to. What afforded past generations the capacity to maintain a stable relationship for 20, 30, 40, 50 years? Now, not again, Stephanie Kuntz is right in that, well, with a lower life expectancy, you know, perhaps especially with respect to men often married later in life because they needed to accumulate a certain degree of wealth beforehand. You know, that the there's lots of moving parts in all of these matters, and the affordance of the, you know, the a lot of people in looking at the divorce rates of the 70s and 80s had made the observation that the observation of marriages breaking up then recalibrated people in terms of what their expectations could be with respect to relationships.
Sure, I'm sure that's right. And I didn't mean to sort of glide over what you said earlier. The things that you mentioned, such as, you know, the technological availability of a kind of sex in pornography and contraceptives. And the thing that Gary Becker emphasized was that this economist, that as the female wage rose in the post-war era, that it became more expensive in terms of foregone income for anybody to stay at home and rear a child. And that was usually women. And so as female wages rose, it became expensive for them to stay at home in terms of what their alternatives they could have. And so the number of children dropped. And that's a worldwide phenomena. So it's not a cultural thing. It's not an American thing. It's just a worldwide phenomena. And so then the less children there are in a marriage, the less, because children are one, I wouldn't say all, but they're one of the benefits of a marriage. Because children are one of the fewer children there are, the less is at stake in marriage breakup and all these kinds of things. I think you're right about these. I think you're right about these effects. There are definitely a lot of moving parts, as you put it.
Mm. Now, here's a question. So I've been Ross Douthat, who's a opinion columnist in the New York Times, recently wrote a very interesting book on decadence. His argument is in the book that a variety of variables, not the least of which is declining birth rates, is at least partly responsible for an imagined stalling of progress basically from the 1970s forward till today.
How's progress defined, Paul?
What's that?
How is progress defined?
Yeah, that's the tricky thing. And so when I first heard this thesis, I was quite doubtful of it. Douthat in his book has a number of chapters that I found to be quite interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, he laid out some things. You know, if you were to live in, let's say between 1860 and 1960, let's look at transportation, economics, technology, many of these things. And then let's say between 1960 and 2020, you know, obviously the information age has been a major change, but you know, your travel time from New York to London or New York to San Francisco hasn't changed much from, let's say, from 1920 to 1960. Your travel time from New York to San Francisco, well, you're going to take a train or an automobile, perhaps, probably a train. But from 1960 to today, your travel time between these two distances, not much has changed. And so anyway, it's a very interesting thesis, and it's a very interesting argument. And a lot of this he ties to questions of birth rate. And of course, for me, this gets into all kinds of very difficult questions to answer, such as the good. But what strikes me about your thesis and these fundamentals, which I think you're very much right about them, that these are in many ways the sort of the presuppositions that are commonly shared and have in, we would say that perhaps it's since the 60s that the third one comes online, really. Before the 60s, not as much. What will happen if these three, if especially the first two give way? And, you know, because in the 20th century, I think it's part, you know, so where did we get these presuppositions from? I think it's not too hard to assert that the Western democracies that won both the Second World War and the Cold War, well, of course, democracy is better than either communism or fascism because we won the war. Of course, free markets are better than a Soviet-style centrally planned economy. In the 20th century, however, you know, some of these, you know, especially in the 1920s and 30s, some of these were very much up for grabs. You know, many intellectuals in the 20s and 30s imagined that, well, communism is clearly the way of the future because here our intentionality and our capacity to wield these new technologies such as economics will yield prosperity, and then it didn't. Now, a lot of the things knocking on the door when you read someone like, let's say, Yuval Harari is saying, well, democracy is, well, as Google and Facebook continue to tinker with our definitions of good, you know, maybe AI will be the new state. And Facebook, as we speak, is trying to set up its own Supreme Court to judge censorship on their platform. So, you know, it's very interesting. It's very interesting to wonder what kind of a society we will have with different fundamentals.
That's a great question. With the economic one, you mentioned the Soviet central planning, and I am actually persuaded by that, I have to say. When I look at a country like it's nice to take places that are in many respects similar culturally, but they have different economic systems. Unfortunately, they have different political systems as well, so it's hard to really pin it down. But you look at North and South Korea, you look at Hong Kong and mainland China, you look at East and West Germany, and at least you can say this, I think, that the combined system of Marxism plus central planning was not as effective economically as the kind of market system. So you don't, it's hard to get controlled experiments in these things, but as far as they go, I find those fairly persuasive myself, as far as, you know, the economy, the central planning. I mean, it's interesting. You never know what the future holds, and we are now at the stage where information technology is getting so sophisticated that maybe sometime in the future, central planning, quite differently to how the Soviets envisaged it, might become feasible again. And so that's an interesting question for the future, but I don't think we're anywhere near that yet. So I'm kind of persuaded about the pragmatic usefulness of the market system over and above those other things. With democracy, I think a key question is, does democracy help vulnerable people, or help the weak, we might put it that way, without meaning any patronizing? I mean, it's a tribute to Nietzsche that if you talk about the weak, it sounds patronizing. I don't mean it that way. I just mean that some people are more powerful than others in this world, and that's just a fact. So I think a key thing about democracy is, does it protect vulnerable people? And I think it doesn't necessarily, because if you have populist governments, if you have a kind of social atmosphere which doesn't care about people who are weak or marginalized, I don't see anything in democracy that will necessarily make it care for the weak or the disadvantaged people in the world. Now, historically, it has done so. It's had a better record than kind of totalitarian democracy. states, and at least in some dimensions. And I think that's probably because democracy is empowered to be what I'd call good democracy when it has an idea, when this idea that people are fundamentally equal is not just at voting time, but it actually permeates the system, that people have fundamentally equal value. When that's in place, I think democracy is a very good system. But as that wanes, or as that perishes through time, I'm not so sure what that will mean for democracy. I have a really interesting tutorial that I take my classes with. I'd love to talk about if I can do that. Yeah, sure. So what I do is there was this great article about fixing up pollution in the world. This was a serious proposition by some academics, that we breed everybody to be half the size and we have patches on our hands to stop us like eating meat. So if you were to shrink everybody into dwarfs and make everybody eat plant-based food, you would reduce the environmental impact of the population of the world enormously, maybe even halve it, because the ecological footprint of us depends a lot on our mass and on our size. So anyway, this was suggested as a serious alternative to other policies that they had in mind talking about global warming. But the point stands, even if you're just talking about pollution. And so I give this to my classes and I say, who agrees with this being a compulsory policy that we breed people to be smaller? And can you guess how many people support it, Paul?
Almost nobody.
That's right. Nobody supports it. So I then ask them, who believes in breeding animals and as, you know, providing no cruelties involved, it's just for breeding animals and you treat them pretty well. And about half of the people do. So I ask that half, okay, if you believe it's okay to breed animals, why don't you believe it's okay to breed people? And they can't usually answer it. They fluff around for a while. So eventually I just put it to them and I say, look, you think people are more valuable than animals, don't you? And they say, yes, we do. And then I say, why? And there are three answers that come up. The first answer is some kind of spiritual or religious answer. So as a Christian, this is the one I would hold, that people are a special creation by God, so they have special dignity relative to animals. Animals are not, animals are important, but people have a sort of supreme dignity. And there are other religions or spiritual aspects which affirm that. So that's one group of answers. The next group of answers is that it's an illusion. We're not actually more valuable than animals, but because just like dogs might look after other dogs in preferences to cats, or herd animals might look after each other in the herd, we look after each other. And part of that is the delusory belief that we're more valuable than animals, but it's a lie. And then the third belief, and this is by far and away the most common one, is that we are more valuable than animals because of our greater capacities. So capacities for relationships, dexterity, creativity, all these things. Even if you allow animals have a certain amount of these, it's clear, I think self-evident, that humans have a far greater abundance of many of these capacities. And that, I think, is the most popular view. The one about it being an illusion runs into the problem of Jean-Paul Sartre called bad faith, where you continue to believe something, that people are more valuable than animals, but you know the reason you have for believing it is a lie. And that's a kind of corrosive of your own integrity, really. So the third answer is really the one that I think flies the best. So I said, okay, we're more valuable than animals because of our greater capacities. So I say, what about applying that criteria that you've just decried across species within species? Are people equal? Are they fundamentally equal? And that's when the conversation gets very interesting. And I think that ultimately clear thinking people, if they reject any kind of spiritual notion or any kind of spiritual purpose for the human race, will find it very difficult to not assert that people actually aren't equal or aren't equally valuable. And some of my students actually say that. They say, oh, on reflection, I think people aren't equal or aren't equally valuable. And that, I think, is the big difference between democracy and sexual and market freedom. I think democracy still holds on to that, at least at voting time, and maybe at other times. It still holds on to that idea that people have fundamental equal value. But I don't think market economics and sexual freedom has any pretensions that people are equal. And I think that particularly, and perhaps we've always accepted that for markets, but what's relatively new is in the sexual arena, we don't think that people are all equally valuable and deserve equal treatment.
Because sexual selection is all about preference. And in fact, marriage is. It's terribly uneconomic, which, you know, if you read, let's say, Brave New World, well, you're not allowed to have preference. And another book that it's less likely that you've read, a book about the Oneida community at the end of the 19th century, which is a fascinating book because here this little free sex, egalitarian, sort of Christian, community that eventually went completely American mid-20th century economic selling flatware. But the origins of it, the founder of it did not permit what he called, sticky love, where once two people got too close, he would, basically put in a request to have sexual relations with anyone in the commune, but it was centrally planned. So the sexual aspect was centrally planned, and it eventually wandered over into eugenics, unsurprisingly. Now I'm really curious because, of course, I was in Australia seems like forever ago because of this pandemic. I was in Australia in 2019, and Australia, interestingly enough, is this large land mass with 25 million-ish population, not very far away from billions and billions of people, one of which being the People's Republic of China, where ideas of democracy are not seen with much, are not looked upon, but also at the same time, they are creating this entire economy of value with respect to government cooperation and a social score. And I'm curious, it's your book is really interesting because here you have this Australia is in some ways sort of this island of Westernality in the East, and obviously continuing to get significant levels of immigration from other countries of the East and significant influence. I'm curious how your book plays in Australia in this way, given the fact that China, quite clearly, I think, is central, a one-party government, dabbling in, getting into free market economics. I'm really curious where this goes with them.
Yeah, I've tried to write the book in a way that it's not particularly culturally specific. Australia seems to me to follow many of the trends that other Western countries do. So some of the things we've been talking about relationships are true in Australia as they are in the US. The shift in politics from about the 1980s onwards, which was more in favour of market deregulation and led to greater inequality, that's true in Australia as well. Although there are more what economists call transfer payments in Australia than there are in the US. So taxes are higher and benefits to people are generally higher. It's interesting. Certainly different political systems value things differently. Going back to what you said about sex, I suppose I have to be a little bit careful. There's equality along several different dimensions. So I don't mean that I think that people are all equal when people are choosing marriage partners, for example. Obviously, there are differences in people. There are things that people find attractive, things that they don't. And I actually think that's a God-given thing, and it's something to be celebrated and enjoyed for a period of time. But if relationship formation and breakdown is a kind of ongoing thing that happens all through one's life, then that becomes the norm of how one lives all the time. And that seems to me to be not a great thing. It's kind of not good for people to be in that situation all the time. But there's also a sense of what we were talking about before, whether you treat people as things or whether you treat people as people. So the difference is, if you buy a car, it no longer ceases to function very well for you, you get rid of it. So if, you know, your parents are supporting you, you value them, but if they stop supporting you or they get old and frail, you just break contact with them because you can't get anything out of them anymore. That kind of market mentality applied to relationships is what I think is very destructive. And I think it's part of the encroachment of market thinking onto the world. Yeah.
Do you think there are bulwarks against that in democracy?
Yes, I think there are. That's a great question. I haven't thought about it in quite those terms, but for example, if economic inequality gets too severe, although I do actually agree with you that sometimes concern about equality is not so much a concern for the least privileged other people. It's a concern for me that I want to get my hands on what the rich have got. So concern about inequality has all sorts of motives. But whatever the motives, it's true that if economic inequality gets too severe, then you might start to get in a democracy, you might start to get democratic pressure against it. So I think that's right. I think democracy does do that. It's harder with the sexual revolution, I think, because that's a very complicated question. But I guess for example, children don't vote, young children don't vote. But if they could vote, would they vote for the kinds of conventions and laws that we have about marriage dissolution? I don't know. That's a very good question. But they can't vote. They're too young to do that. And this is one of the other, this is the other problem about democracy, is who's in and who's out as far as who can vote. And democracy is a great technology for stopping a small group oppressing a large group. But as long as we don't forget that some people can't vote and their interests have to be protected as well. You can't rely on them protecting their own interests through their vote, because they can't.
Well, and which interests? I often, you know, when you get down to the American political system, regularly, let's say, people on the left complain because they would argue that many of the people on the right vote for who they vote for because of, in American politics, what we label as social issues have tended to dominate, issues such as abortion. So on the right, it tends to be abortion. On the left, it tends to be, let's say, gay, LGBT rights. And you can hear this because, or anti-racism, you can hear this because these are the defeater arguments brought out into the political space in order to scare your group back, you know, to keep them from wandering from the base. And so one argument will say it's all about the Supreme Court justices so that we can overturn Roe versus Wade. And the other side will say it's all about Supreme Court justices so that we can keep them from overturning same-sex marriage. And what's interesting is that even though, you know, James Carville says it's the economy, stupid, when I look at the way a lot of people without a lot of money vote, they voted for tax cuts for very wealthy people, you know, in order to hopefully one day overturn, you know, make abortions harder to get. And it's like, well, this is very interesting the way this democracy is working. But I'm very interested in your idea of, and I would phrase it this way, James K. Smith is a philosopher at Calvin College who has written some books on what he calls cultural literacy or cultural liturgies. And Jordan Peterson, in terms of a lot of his work about human behavior, talks about the fact that we act things out. This acting things out is something very deep and basic in terms of our formation about a lot of these presuppositions. And I think you're very much on to something in democracy that the acting out of voting becomes a strong cultural liturgy for ideas of human equality. Even though, you know, right now there's all kinds of concern about is Russia trying to influence the election on Facebook? I talked about this with someone yesterday and I said, yeah, my mother is too. My mother is trying to influence the election on Facebook. It's just that when we think about Russia doing it, on one hand, Russia is more powerful than my mother. On the other, I've used this illustration now twice, and she's going to stop using me as illustrations in your videos, Paul. Just like my kids don't like me using them as illustrations in my sermons. But this is a very interesting idea of democracy as sort of a cultural liturgy that, you know, every couple of years we all practice something which deeply communicates a certain equality of people. And I love that little illustration about why people are more valuable than animals, because again, so often with so many of these fundamentals, these presuppositions, if you ask people about them, they'll sort of look at you like, you know, this is something I know and believe, but don't ask me to justify it. And so some part of the brain will just make up a story that to satisfy themselves emotionally. But I really am interested in this idea of democracy as a formation mechanism that attempts to reinstill within people at a very deep level the equality of people. And I think, you know, obviously Christianity, church, these kinds of religious liturgies have the same effect in us. And the discomfort that you feel as a Christian, which of course I would agree with, that increasingly market dynamics being used and people being part of them is something that is giving you dissonance on the level of your presuppositions. You want to say, hey, people are to be loved and not used, which is of course, you know, the deep at the heart of the Christian message.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a nice phrase, actually, that voting is a ritual or a liturgy. I think it is. I think it's a moment where people affirm that even the most ignorant or incapable or, for want of a better word, weak contributor to society has the same say as somebody else. I also agree that Christianity proclaims equality of people in certain respects that are absolutely fundamental. I think it's important to say what they are. They're by virtue of creation, that God's created everybody. Everyone is, as it were, his property. And so we all stand equal before him on that basis. It's not very complimentary to say this, but we're all sinners. So we're all equal in that respect. As the Bible puts it, everybody has fallen short of God's standards. And another great biblical theme is redemption, that God has sought us and wants to save us, and that's offered indiscriminately. So as it says in John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his son, that whosoever should believe in him should not perish but have eternal life. So it's offered to everybody without distinction, so on an equal basis. So yes, yeah, so I think that those foundations for equality are certainly very deep in Christianity, and not only for that reason, but partly for that reason, they're very deep in the West as well, because of course the Christian tradition has formed the West alongside other things. So yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And so I think people are right to feel uncomfortable with depersonalization and to feel as though they're just machines or parts of a cogs in a machine that are going to be used and discarded when they're no longer necessary. And so these are great tensions in our society. And I think to go back to the two people, do you want to know who I think are prophets for Western fundamentalism?
Yeah.
Everybody has to have, every great religion or movement has to have prophets, even anti-authoritarian ones. They often cite people with such reverence that you get the sense that they actually are prophets. Well, I think John Stuart Mill and Nietzsche are the prophets for Western fundamentalism. So John Stuart Mill says that people, you can do whatever you like up to the limit of where you start to hurt somebody else. And so that sort of strongly gives the impression that all preferences are as good as each other as long as they don't actually cross anybody. And then Nietzsche comes in and helps us, because that actually doesn't answer a lot of the questions of life, because many of the things we do impact on other people. In fact, if you have a functioning community, that's almost its definition, that what you do impacts others and what they do impacts you. So John Stuart Mill's criteria is a very weak criteria, which won't work for a lot of social situations. So what do you do in situations where whatever you do, you're going to impact others? Well, Nietzsche says that the strong, the powerful, the beautiful, they have a moral right to marginalize the weak, because that will restore Greco-Roman greatness to the West, which was lost when Christianity came onto the scene and perverted everything good in culture and moved us away from the kinds of celebration of strength, beauty, dexterity that was the Greco-Roman world. And I see that coming back through sort of unfettered market liberalism, which rewards those who are marketable. And surprise, surprise, the people who are marketable are often strong, beautiful, dexterous, etc.
And intelligent. I mean, intelligent is often not in that list, but yes, when you listen to people talk, well, he's a smart person, but I mean, intelligence is sort of the, well, there's the, well, who should, I mean, Plato, who should reign? The philosopher king, golds.
That's right, that's right. And I have to say, also hardworking. I mean, the market system does reward hard work. It sends financial rewards your way. It's more likely to send financial rewards your way if you work hard. So it's a complex picture. There's good and bad thrown in there. But maybe limiting markets to a certain sphere of activity is a good idea, and keeping that mentality, that cost-benefit analysis, ruthless cost-benefit analysis, away from a lot of spheres of life is a good idea.
I agree with you. I mean, that's a part of the difficulty of this conversation, is there's so much agreement. but the question I think is, okay, what will limit the markets? What will limit this? And I would assert that it is probably religious ideas and commitments. And for example, in the context of a marriage, in a sense, what a marriage vow does is close down certain kinds of marketplaces, because the individual says, well, I might, 10, 15 years from now, by virtue of how I've aged versus how you've aged, how much money I've made, I mean, depending on the different men and women come to the marketplace with different values that are appreciated by the other side. In a sense, what a marriage vow does is say, I am off the market. And we even use that language. And what's interesting is that it is often these religious ideas and religious communities that and religious liturgies that limit the market. And in a sense, as so I listen to a lot of conversations and podcasts from secular people who are very much wrestling with similar things that you're dealing with here. The difficulty that they have is once the religious realm is sort of pushed aside, the question is, what in fact will limit the market? And then people have all of these ideas about, well, we've got to care for the weak. And then someone like Tom Holland will come along and say, well, where do you get that idea? And Nietzsche will step right in and say, it's very clear where you get that idea. You get that idea from Christianity. Douthat, in one of his interviews with respect to his book, made the observation that, you know, it appeared in the 20th century, you know, if you read literature, social literature, going all the way up to the Second World War, ideas such as eugenics, involuntary sterilization, a lot of these social Darwinian ideas were very much increasing. And Douthat makes the observation that, and as does Tom Holland, that in many ways, Nazi ideology was, you know, in full-throated embracing of this Nietzschean ideal. And the Nazis had this idea that, you know, what really went wrong is all of these higher level ideas. And if we can only look at the way the world really is, which we can see now through a Darwinian lens, that it's important to get rid of states and get rid of inhibitions from kind of a natural jungle order to take over. And so they very quietly, Hitler, in his first attempted control at power, realized that all of his anti-church rhetoric was not doing him any favors. And so part of what he did in terms of gaining power was figure out how to mollify the church so that he can basically come in and take. And so what's happening now in a lot of camps, highly secular camps, is that increasingly they are looking for a religion that isn't a religion, because they recognize we need a buffer against markets, against these Nietzschean Darwinian impulses, because they are so powerful. And religion played that role. And it, once it's taken from the field, these other fundamentals, with the possible exception of some of that democratic liturgy, seem unable to restrain the avarice of the intelligent and the strong and the beautiful from finally taking what they will.
That's fascinating. I hadn't thought about it in quite those terms, but I think that just going back to the Nazis, I think that the Nazis do embody one part of Nietzsche, which is his contempt for weakness. So he says in one of his writings that the weak and the failures shall perish in the earth, and they shall be given every possible assistance. This is our neighbor love. This is what Nietzsche said. So the idea of giving them every possible assistance is just it just echoes horrifically with what the Nazis did. I don't think Nietzsche would have been a Nazi for a couple of reasons. He hated anti-Semitism, he didn't really think in racial categories that much. He had this idealized overman that was more like Goethe. He wasn't running a death camp. He'd be a kind of artist and so on. So I think Nietzsche probably would. Well, he wasn't an anti-Semite, so he wouldn't have been a Nazi. But his ideas about strength and weakness, yes, I think that the Nazis really took that up. And as you probably know, Nietzsche's sister was given a state funeral by Hitler, and there was a lot of recognition that this was the case, that there was mutual influence there. As to what will stand in the way of the market, whether marriage what will keep marriage alive as an institution, I'm just not sure. I mean, my Christian stance or belief is that marriage is a creation thing, that it's given to everybody, and so it's not like communion, for example, which is just given to the church. So I think that it's possible that even if Christianity wanes in certain areas, that there will be other reasons that people will come back to value marriage, that people might think that the world is in a sufficient mess, that we've gone too far in that area. They might go back. But I agree with you that certainly having a transcendent view in place, a transcendent reason for valuing people or treating people in a certain way, is a protection against the market. My secular friends tease me and they talk about having a skyhook for my views, but it's not a bad expression. You know, the idea is that certain things about my views need outside God to come in and sort of support them with a hook coming from the sky. But it's good natured criticism, and I sort of take it that I think that certain ways of thinking definitely are informed from outside. As a Christian, they're informed by revelation, and if you abandon them, it is very difficult to know why you would not at least have a Nietzschean survival of the fittest ethic as an option. I can understand existentialists saying, well, look, we can make up whatever value, whatever society, whatever human creation we like. We don't happen to like Nietzschean values. We like something else. I can understand that. It's their free choice. That's the whole thing about existentialism. You're not bound. You just make up whatever you like. But to say that that's an impossible choice to make, or that it shouldn't be made, I can't understand that at all. I can't understand why, if somebody regards people as mere animals. Hitler actually put it best. He said, "I cannot understand why man should not be as cruel as nature." What's the reason for saying you might choose not to do that? But what reason are you giving, is apart from your raw arbitrary choice?
Right. I was working through some of this stuff a little bit a few months ago. You know, I was reading a fair amount of Timothy Snyder. I don't know if you've come across his books. Written a book, Black Earth, about you know, the Nazis, Bloodlands, which is sort of the Poland, Belarus, Ukraine in the 30s. I mean, because they had the unfortunate distinction of being subject to experiments from the far right and the far left. You know, first Stalin,
geographically and politically.
Yeah, first Stalin takes them apart, and then Hitler comes through and runs his experiment on, and then Stalin comes back. I mean, these poor people, and these are not easy books to read by any means. But I mean, Timothy Snyder's observation was devastating in that. And I had always wondered what was at the heart of Nazi anti-Semitism, given the fact that, you know, even as late as the First World War and the Middle War period, it was obvious that Jewish intellectuals, scientists, engineers were in many ways at the forefront of so much in German culture. Well, you know, I think Timothy Snyder makes a compelling argument, as do other scholars of Nazism, that, you know, it was kind of a rabid Darwinian perspective on Hitler's part that, again, I think you're right about Nietzsche. The Nazis can't necessarily wholly be laid at his feet. But it was the perspective that all of this second order thinking, by which we would have a morality which would we would have presuppositions which would come from someplace other than nature itself, led to the assertion that these ideas of regard for the weak, which clearly are can be found in the Old and New Testament, that these things should be dismissed. And I am quite compelled by the fact that part of the reason that these Western fundamentals have become so ubiquitous, unquestioned, presuppositional, and yet people are, you know, unconsciously embracing them is because of the 20th century, in which both sides were tried at the cost of so much blood. And I think Douthat is right that, in a sense, the West was probably trotting towards, okay, we're getting away from Christianity, we're getting away from all of this. All we really need is science. And then you run into the Soviets and the Nazis and you say, oh, no, neither of those. But what to do with religion, there's the quandary.
Yeah, I think that, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book, actually. I think the Second World War was a wake-up call for the West. And I think that the danger is that as the memory of the Second World War wanes, that we will go back on, and some of the debates that are emerging now are along the same lines that they were in the early 20th century. You see it now with discussion about designer babies and so on. I think that the Second World War, it's an unfathomably large tragedy. And yet the good that came out of it was that it made people aware of the dangers of things like eugenics, rampant racism, destruction of minorities and so on. As a Christian, I'd say it's a mirror moment where you look at human nature and see how bad it can be, how bad we can all be. Because it wasn't just Hitler, of course. He was a genius at taking advantage of human nature, but it's still human nature. I really like what Solzhenitsyn says about this, that because he had every, the Soviet writer Solzhenitsyn had every reason to turn Stalin into the good guy and the bad guy and everybody else into the good guys. But he didn't say that. He said that the line separating good and evil goes between everybody's heart. And I think that's so right. I have an image of how people in the West process evil or think about evil. It's the image of a centrifuge. So a centrifuge spins round and round and round and pushes certain things right out to the fringe. If you want to separate blood or something, you use a centrifuge. Well, I think that people in the West now process evil in this way, that they only recognize evil on the fringe. They only recognize it in the big bad consequences of terrorism, pedophilia, dictatorships, the Hitlers and Stalins of the world. They recognize evil there, but they don't recognize their own ordinary, mundane, petty evil. And so people don't believe in evil, except that they believe it for things like September 11. So I'm old enough to have noticed the change in discourse after September 11. People started to use the word evil much more freely. They had always used it for the Nazis, but they didn't use it the exact word, but they used words like sick or whatever, barbaric. But evil came back into popular discourse after September 11. And I think this is the danger of using World War II, although it's been a great blessing for us to use World War II as a wake-up call. The danger is that we only recognize evil in its extreme forms. We don't recognize it in ourselves. Because I think many people in the West think that they are basically good people that the system is wrecking. And I don't really agree with that as a Christian.
Interesting. I've peppered you with questions for 2 hours. I hope you haven't felt too cross-examined. Who is your book for?
My book's really for two groups of people whom I think might find it interesting. I think Christians who are feeling increasingly marginalized in the secular world might find it interesting, and they might find that the way to, I guess, apply biblical ideas or Christian themes to what they see going on around them, I hope that that will be useful to them. But I also think it's of interest to people who perhaps feel marginalized in the West and feel that their cultures are constantly looked down on. When really Western people are often very bad at looking at their own failings or presuppositions. So I hope that it will be of interest to them as well. So the style of writing really comes out of my teaching. Been successful and has won awards and so on. So I enjoy engaging with young people. So I suppose it's written for a younger audience. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anything else you wanna plug or say or anything before we wrap this up?
No, I mean, if plugging, there's the book.
I like the barcode on the front. I like the cover. It's a clever cover.
Yeah. I saw another artwork where somebody is walking and they just basically turn into a barcode. So that's where I got the idea of the barcode. But I've really enjoyed talking, and I'm fascinated to hear, just fascinating to hear your perspectives on these things as well, Paul. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Gordon. And my day is ending, but yours is just beginning there in tomorrow land.
That's right. That's right. Well, have a good night.
All right. Well, have a good rest of your day. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.